Charlene. In these 20-minute podcasts, I talk with memoir writers about their books, their lives, and their writing process. Sharing like this helps us all connect. As we listen, we learn about the world through the eyes of others. Their stories help us expand our views and empathize more deeply with each other. It's my pleasure now to invite you to listen in to this episode of Life Story on Soul Sciences. Hello, everyone. I'm here today with Myra Goodman, and Myra has written a memoir. It's called Quest for Eternal Sunshine. Welcome to the program, Myra.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be chatting with you.
Myra, let's jump right in. What is your book about?
My book, Quest for Eternal Sunshine, it's my father's life story. And the subtitle is A Holocaust Survivor's Journey from Darkness to Light. Now, the book is actually divided into four parts. And I do want to tell your listeners that it's based on an unfinished manuscript that I found after he died. So he had written about his life and about his healing journey. And he really wanted to get his philosophy and his messages out to the world, but English was his fourth language. He wasn't a writer. He was actually an inventor. And so it never got to a form where he could get a publisher interested. So I want people to understand that I found this manuscript. It didn't have hardly any name, any dates. It had poems. It had memoir. More than half was philosophy. And it was very, very difficult to read. So I spent over 4 years trying to get this in a form that was readable, that also communicated the philosophy and the wisdom that he was so determined to share. And about half of it was written based on research that I conducted to fill in the blanks that he had left behind. He never talked about the Holocaust growing up. The book is actually divided into four parts. The first part, part one, is The World I Came From. And so that talks about his hometown in Poland, being raised a Hasidic Jew between the two world wars, rituals, what living like in an Orthodox Hasidic life in Poland was like. And then you go through the war and you go through the concentration camps and you go through after the war when he learned that his family, his four siblings, his mother and father had all been murdered in Auschwitz. He was sure that everyone had been killed, but it turned out that one of his younger sisters had survived. So it ends when he finds his sister and finds out from her what happened to their family, because he had actually left earlier. He became a slave laborer in Nazi concentration camps earlier in the war. So that's part one. Part two is called The World I Discovered. And that is from the moment he arrives in Ellis Island in Manhattan and what his life is like. And what's interesting about the book is that it's quite a odyssey, both in the real world and inside his own mind and heart. And I wrote first person in my father's voice because his intimate memoir tone was the tone that really touched me and struck me. So I spent 4 years really holding my dad close and writing in his voice. So he/we shared his life. He had written the internal stuff. So you said he joined this new age spiritual community. And that's where I was raised. And that was when he really started doing this inner work. He had decades of depression, feeling very emotionally isolated, living in fear, nightmares from the moment he was liberated from the concentration camp. And so he started this healing journey. And then part four is The World Inside Me. And he shares his observations of his mind, his emotions, what he learned, and how he was able to retrain his thought patterns and teach his body how to feel joy and how to feel pleasure, how to let go of suffering. And there's beautiful life-changing techniques that we can talk about if we have time. And then part four is called The World of Wonder, where we're sharing his wisdom with readers, and people are finding that it really is life-affirming and life-changing.
That is absolutely true. And it is one of the reasons I really wanted to do this podcast with you, because, as you know, I like to pursue the stories of people who have struggled and come through, because my interest is, how do we heal as people from the most awful things? And your dad's story certainly was truly emblematic of that, really very much what he did. Would you talk to our gatherers more about the spiritual journey? Because he didn't stay in that spiritual group. As I recall, he got deeply involved enough to buy one of the communal properties where you say you were raised. Would you fill us in on some of that, please?
Right. He married my mom. He married my mom kind of late in life for back those days. He was in his late 30s. And he really credits my mom with helping him become aware that he was living a very unhappy life. He said he, you know, it was sort of like a fish doesn't know it swims in water. He had always been depressed. He'd always been fearful. And so my mom let him know that something was wrong. And as soon as he became aware of that, he said it was as if an alarm clock went off in his mind, and he was unwilling to waste the rest of his life living what he called as a second-class citizen on this planet. And so he said that he first went window shopping. He tried all these different forms of therapy. He tried hypnotherapy and gestalt therapy and talk therapy. And then he discovered a little group back then, it was in 1970, called the Pathwork. And it was centered around a woman named Eva Perakis, who was a channel for a spirit called the guide. Whether you believe it or not, I actually personally do believe in communicating with spirits, and I've done it. I think that was definitely going on, but then over time, there is question about whether it was only the guide coming through with different things that were being communicated, but that was later on. But they were very taken with the wisdom coming in from the guide. And at first, it was just a group of people that were meeting on Saturday nights. And Eva would go into a trance, and the guide would talk about different subjects. And this group grew. And originally, Eva and her husband, who was a psychotherapist, who had founded something called bioenergetics.
Now, what would be the name of that therapist?
His name is John Perakis. He's dead now.
Yeah.
Now, but I know that he used to go to Esalen. Do you recognize the name?
No, but what I do recognize is bioenergetics. And the person who was actually the founder of that, in terms of writing a book called Language of the Body back in 1971, was Alexander Lowen. And he had studied under Reich. Wilhelm Reich. And so this John person you're speaking of may indeed have also been a student of Reich's. I don't know.
Well, that's what, you know, I didn't study it, but he was supposed to have been Alan Lowen's partner.
Alexander Lowen's partner. Okay. Yeah. Now that makes sense. Okay.
So if you Google him, you will see it. And then he created something called Core Energetics that was, I guess, an offshoot of it.
Sure.
So these principles were part of the Pathwork. So We bought a property in upstate New York that used to be a motel, and it became, you know, a very insular community. I mean, they wanted to grow, they wanted to get bigger, but, you know, the guide really explained the way the world worked. We had a very serious belief system, really like any religion that could explain how everything works. And there were these principles of how reincarnation was part of it. So you wanted to work through your negative feelings and your lower self to get to your higher self. So there was a lot of gestalt group interactions, working through things. There was studying the lectures as a kid. We all had helpers that we met with every week that were a therapist. We had kid groups. So I grew up from when I was 6 to when I was 13 in this community. And then my parents had started early, and they were very high-level members. And we were the first high-level members to ever leave the Pathwork. And so it was a very traumatic thing. And that's when we realized that it did have some cult properties, because it wasn't like, okay, goodbye, we wish you well, we love you. It was that they had to discredit my parents, that, and anybody who stayed friends with them were, you know, giving in to their lower selves, and it was betraying the Pathwork. And so it was this it was this very traumatic leaving. My mother, who had been depressed earlier in her life, went into this deep depression. And for me, I had to leave my friends, my belief system, my home, my school within a matter of 2 weeks. And couldn't, you know, there weren't, you know, no internet back then. I couldn't say goodbye to my, it was over a summer. I couldn't say goodbye to my friends at my local public school. I just disappeared and started a whole new school. I started ninth grade. We moved to Manhattan. It was a very traumatic break for our family. And that was, though, I think the pathway was very, very beneficial for both my parents in a lot of ways, even though the leaving was traumatic. And my dad, you know, they'd both been what they called helpers, so they were able to be therapists without therapy training. I think that gave him a lot of confidence. It was when he started writing. It was when he started meditating. And so afterwards, after we left the path, he said it was really time for him to go out on his own and not rely on the philosophy of someone else. And he spent years just really deeply observing his mind and his thought pattern. The teacher that he was, that he admired and learned from the most was Krishnamurti.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so he went and saw him speak twice, once in Switzerland, he took the family, and once in Southern California. He looked at his mind and he looked at himself as kind of a focus group of one on how the human brain functions. Yeah. And he started realizing that he was replaying a tape of the past, and that this terrifying, depressing, you know, dark world that he was seeing was a projection of his own mind, and that he could change it. And he did. And I have to say that part of my motivation and my devotion to this book is that my dad truly became the most peaceful, happiest, kindest person I've ever known in my whole life. So it's like what he did worked, and that's why I want to share it. And you and I, you know, we're talking about trauma and trauma resolution. And I think you can't compare trauma. I think one of my issues and my personal trauma was I always felt, well, nothing that I've gone through counts because it wasn't the Holocaust. My trauma bar was too high. So I would deny my sadness or my pain or my grief because it didn't count. And since I've learned that you can't judge what is traumatic for one, you know, for someone getting reprimanded in front of a whole classroom by a teacher could cause them the deepest trauma, and someone else could have gotten physically attacked and go through it more easily. You know, you don't know what the real terror in his life, even before surviving 3 years in Nazi as a slave laborer in Nazi concentration camps, seeing thousands and thousands of people die and his family being, you know, tortured and murdered. There is something that if my dad could find his way back to love, which is how he describes his journey, you know, there's hope for all of us because it doesn't get that much worse.
Exactly. And Krishnamurti is a man that I like to quote because one of the things he said that absolutely blows me away is it is no sign of good mental health to be well adjusted to a sick society.
Oh, that is a good one.
I love that quote. It is so freeing.
Oh, I got to use that quote.
Yeah.
That's the best quote.
Yeah. It explains so much in so few words, right?
Oh,
and
yeah.
The second thing is what also impressed me and blew me away about your dad's experience was this was way before any of the helps that we have now. We have neuroscience, number one, that tells us, yes, if you are in a PTSD experience, which your dad clearly was, you're going to see life through a gray fog, and that is how it is. You're in like a cocoon. You may not even know, because it's always been like this, that you are in a cocoon, as was your dad's experience. So the fact that he could do this through his own capacity, to me, is something intrinsic to the human nature that he's offering to us that can't be denied. I also want to say, what your discovery is about the nature of trauma, that it doesn't matter how big or how small, where the pain is, what the level of it is. We don't have a beaker that says this is how much pain that causes, and so
right,
we can measure
right
whether you deserve to have that reaction or not. And that's the thing, is it isn't about anybody else measuring your reaction. If you feel hurt by something, or anybody listening feels hurt by something, needs to cry about it, needs to get some insight about it, needs help with it, that is just as valid as you are saying. That is just as valid as anyone who's gone through any really, what we call really bad experiences.
It's true. And through my own work of my own trauma resolution, because I realized I had an overstuffed suitcase of trauma that I kept shoving stuff in. And really, I didn't realize that I had really grown up with these, because I thought of myself as, you know, you can see I'm a very verbal person and I'm very emotional. I thought I was very aware of my emotions, but I have realized recently in my life, I'm 56, that I grew up from the time I was very young, avoiding and repressing all of my sad, upset emotions.
Yep.
And what I'm learning is that when I go back and I spend time letting some of these traumas that might seem small come up, the feeling of that trauma, whether it was shame or hurt or neglect, it has threads that are connected to so many other traumas. And that as soon as you can really feel it in relation to one trauma, you remember others, things start unwinding.
Yes, that has exactly been my experience as well. With many listeners know that I was held captive for 3 days and beaten and tortured and raped. But the point was that as long as that was my set point or where my brain stopped, then the world was really a very different place. It's right. About being able to take in new information. Once right. You've had a pain, it actually shuts down a part of the neuronal structure where the pathways will go or won't go. So your experiences of, you know, I have to track this back and then I get to it. And my guess, Myra, is when you get to it, you know it because it's in your body. You go yes. into your body and your body goes, oh, and you have a cry or a pain or a sweat or a fear or a yell into a pillow or yell out loud or whatever it is that releases from the body. And then the insight that comes after that, the insight is what frees us.
Yes. And the lightning, it's interesting you say that because my whole life I've lived really in my head and I have felt my dad was the only one that would understand this when I was little. I'd say, Daddy, I'm not here. I don't feel here. I've never been in my body. And I didn't understand till recently that is a trauma symptom. That is yes. dissociation. You know, it's interesting. There's two things that I want to say. You know, one thing is my dad, like you were saying, he didn't have access to the kind of knowledge and therapy that we have now. But one of the chapters that I'm assuming that probably you found fascinating was when he went back and when he re-remembered his past.
Yes.
Do you remember? Because what yes. my dad did is he had intuitively, and it reminds me of, you know, psychodrama and these different forms of therapy where people get to have that feeling of safety and security and love that they've never had, they never had that set point. And my dad, who really had no memories of his childhood after the concentration camp, he made a point of spending time trying to remember his past, remember the good things, and flood himself with those memories. And then he took it further and he went back and he imagined, because he grew up at a very scary time and there was a lot of fear. And he went back and he imagined, and his father was aggressive, his father beat him. He was dyslexic. He was failing in school. He went back and he imagined his mother not with this heavy weight of raising these children and this fear of this anti-Semitic culture, but his mother joyous and bouncing and happy and singing and loving him, and his father being tender and kind and him playing with them. And he would spend time in his imagination. And his imagination was so strong. And I believe he felt that in his body, and gave himself a new reference point and a new set point, and that was part of his transformation.
That is exactly so, because the imagination, and we know from neuroscience, that if you can imagine something, an action, an activity, a something, the same neural pathways, the same hormonal experiences will flood your brain to the extent of about two-thirds of what it will be if it's actually happening.
And, you know, and it was, I think some of it was his nature. You know, he talked about how much he daydreamed as a little boy, that he learned from trial and error that he could kind of rescue himself from a very difficult, painful life by having his dreams. And he also, you know, two things around that. One is when he said, when people say, how did you survive the concentration camps? 3 years, more than 1,000 days and nights of brutality and starvation and freezing Polish winters, you know, 30 degrees below zero without shooting, crazy stuff. And he said visualization. He visualized himself warm, eating French fries, you know, and it kept him alive. But the other thing that he said is that he truly believes daydreams / fantasy / visualizations, imaginings as a little boy, that he was sowing the seeds for the happy life that he eventually achieved.
We've come to the end of the discussion for today, Myra.
Thank you.
Bye for now.
Bye.
That's it. That's all for today. Many thanks to Kevin MacLeod for that lovely music, Carefree. And many thanks to all of you who make these podcasts possible. Remember, take good care of each other. Bye for now.